Andy Letcher, thank you for being on and thank you for having me. So I'm going to do a poorer job of introducing you, so maybe you should do this yourself, but you're an author, a lecturer, a musician, a bard, perhaps. So in your own words, who are you? What do you do?
So I'm a senior lecturer at Schumacher College here in Devon, and I lecture broadly in the subjects of ecology and spirituality, and I'm interested in paganism, shamanism, psychedelic spirituality, all the weird stuff. That's my kind of professional life. I'm a writer. I'm the author of a book called Shroom, A Cultural History of the Magic Mushroom, which came out in 2006. I haven't written another book since then, not for lack of trying. Mostly book chapters and academic articles. And then I've had a kind of parallel career as a semi-professional folk musician. And I played in a band called Telling the Bees for nearly a decade, and then gave that up when I started having children.
Yeah, I've been listening to Telling the Bees online. It's very beautiful music.
Thank you.
If anyone's listening, go check out Telling the Bees. There's a YouTube mix you can go click on.
Great. It's beautiful. Thank you.
Stuff, yeah. So here we are in or near Schumacher College. We're in the grounds of Schumacher. So for people who haven't heard of Schumacher and know nothing about it, what is it? Why is it different? Why is it special? And what makes Schumacher Schumacher?
So Schumacher College was set up in the early 90s by an Indian sage and ecologist by the name of Satish Kumar, who is our sort of patron and founder and inspiration. And it was set up to try and challenge some of the orthodoxies at the time with an ecological bent and ecological focus. And so the college exists to promote the cause of ecology, to say that there's a role for spirituality in the world, and to see where those two meet. So we run a number of master's programs and a number of short courses, so people come here for 1 week, 2 weeks. And we also have a growers program in organic horticulture, where people come for 9 months and learn how to grow wonderful food. But because it was set up by Satish, who comes from a Jain background, the college is set up very much on the principles of an ashram. So everybody contributes to the working of the college. So I've just come here from doing the washing up after lunch. And it has a flatter structure than your average university. So in a class, I won't stand there in front of serried ranks of sleeping students. We sit in a circle and we make time for silence and for self-reflection. And it's an amazing place. And I have to pinch myself on a daily basis to go, this is my job. How did I end up here? This is pretty amazing.
Excellent. So, and what do you teach there? What are you teaching?
So I was brought here to teach on and then eventually run a master's program called Ecology and Spirituality, which for complicated reasons is no longer running. And now I'm developing a new residential master's program, which is currently going under the name of Engaged Ecology. And it's going to be a practice-led and transdisciplinary look at how people can act to change the world.
So before you're a teacher, I gather music was part of your attempt to change the world, but from reading your writings online, it seems you got caught in that trap that many talented musicians face, where, you know, we live in this capitalist society where we need to earn a living, and doing so as a musician is extremely hard. You've either got to make it big or just forget about it. So, you know, there's so much wasted talent out there of people trying to become musicians being unable to. How do we change this? How can we allow that talent to flourish despite the demands of capitalism?
That's an excellent question. Well, I think we're all still labouring under the Cinderella myth and the myth of the 60s, which is when the music industry as we know it really kind of exploded into being. And then music was controlled by a small number of record labels who had incredible power. And so if you were a promising band and you got signed, it actually meant something, and it meant that they could promote you to the world. that doesn't exist anymore. People's listening habits have completely changed. People don't really buy albums and listen to them in the same way. I mean, when I'm of the vinyl generation, I used to buy a new record and I would take it home and I would just sit down and listen to it and turn it over at half time, listen to the second half. People don't really do that anymore. There is so much music and so much available for free on YouTube and other channels. It's hard to see how people can make money in the way that people were in the 60s. And yet everyone is laboring under that myth that if only they could break through, if we could just break through, everything would be wonderful and I'd never have to work again. And I'm actually thinking now more radically that it's an industry, right? And as an industry, it's part of capitalism and it's part of the machine that has created the problems we're now facing. So how about this for a radical idea, that musicians decide they're no longer going to record? How about that? Because then the only way you could see that music would be to see it live.
That's actually a very interesting idea.
And recording is, what, 150 years old? The vast majority of the world's human music is gone, is lost to us, because it was never recorded. And maybe that's how it should be, that it's about the moment. It's not about being able to endlessly repeat over and over again, whenever I want, the same feeling, the same piece of music. Maybe we would value it even more if musicians didn't record and we had to go and see it live.
Well, I think that's part of the problem, is that now music has been devalued. It's seen as almost an unnecessary luxury rather than as a kind of fundamental important part of life. Mm. Do you see it as a more kind of a fundamental necessity, or do you feel it's, you know, like I don't know, like cake, for example? You know, you can eat cake and enjoy it, but it's not necessary.
No, it's definitely not cake. It's I see it as absolutely fundamental to who we are as humans. I mean, we have this extraordinary ability to play music, to make music together, to be affected by music. And I think, again, part of the thing that capitalism has done is it's separated out a class of people who are musicians. You're the musicians and you're the audience. And it's everybody's birthright. Everyone is a musician. We are all innately musical. We do everything to some kind of rhythm. There's a huge amount of cognitive research happening at the moment to demonstrate exactly the importance of music. Let me give you one example. There was a study where people measured the stress levels of preterm babies. So this is babies that are born premature and they're in incubators, and you can measure their stress levels, or an indication of their stress levels, by measuring the levels of cortisol, the stress hormone, in their saliva. And what they got someone to play a harp to these babies for, I think, 2 hours, something like that. And then they measured their levels of stress, both before and after. And these are babies that should not be in the world. They should still be in the womb. They should not have any response to music. But their stress levels went down significantly. So what this implies is that music... the ability to respond to music is completely hardwired into us. It's possible we even sang before we spoke, that language is a sort of crystallization or a condensation out of music. And when my I have twin boys, young twin boys, and when one of them was learning to speak, his first word was look. But it wasn't look as you and I would recognize it. He went something more like "ook, ook." Now that's not a word, that's music. It's a kind of punctuated sound. So it's possible that we were singing and conveying meaning through singing before we developed this condensation, this crystallization into language. And why is it that you can listen to a piece of music and it can convey emotions for which we have no words? Like that happy combination of joy and sorrow and ecstasy and agony and all those things, you know, that music at its highest brings out in us this feeling, this extraordinary feeling for which there are no words. And yet you play the bit of music and you listen to it and you're taken there. well, that implies that it's hardwired, and it's not cake. We can live without cake. I don't think we can live without music. And I would say it's probably one of those fundamental things that is found in all human cultures at all times. Music, some kind of religion, and some kind of altered state of consciousness, normally through the use of plants. I think there's only one exception to that last, and that's the Inuit, but there were no plants growing where they are, and they certainly found other ways of achieving altered states of consciousness. So we have this universal drive in us to make music. I mean, it's incredibly costly in terms of time. You know, it takes a long time to master an instrument. It kind of implies that if you want to read it in a Darwinian sense, there's some selective advantage to us having music. And it obviously bonds us as people, as a group. And
Well, I wonder if we've lost that in this digital age now, where, you know, almost all the music most people listen to is just on a computer or an MP3 player or something like that on their phone. And, though, you know, of course we still have live performances, but, you know, perhaps we're not really, you know, bound together by music in the same way we used to be in tribal societies, or even more recently where we had like a bard sort of tie together the local society. So I've seen people call you a bard. What is that? How does that work? How did it work, and how does it work now? What is bardism to you?
So I've carried this nickname, Andy the Bard, for 20 odd years. I sort of picked it up when I was a road protester, an environmental activist, at the Newbury bypass. This was in 1995, and I used to sort of prance around with a big hat with a feather in it and a mandolin, singing songs, and I suppose it seemed like an apt name. And I think bardism is a role, and it's found cross-culturally, and I think we had it too, and the Greek and Roman sources tell us we had bards in the Iron Age. And traditionally the bards were the storytellers, the people who remembered people's lineages, the poets, but they also composed praise poems for their leaders, so they were kind of spin doctors as well, I suppose. And there's a move afoot at the moment within contemporary spirituality, and particularly within contemporary druidry, to try and revive the figure of the bard, which people are doing, and people are establishing bardic competitions around the country, and I think there's a Bard of Exeter just up the road. I think what people are doing, though, now, and what I was doing when I was really wearing that label, is something slightly different. I've looked at a lot more traditional bardic cultures now, particularly in Africa, and there's less emphasis on individual creativity and expressiveness, and they often play music that to our ears sounds quite repetitive, but they're improvising poetry and improvising a poem in praise of someone who's done something wonderful. It might be the village leader or a village elder, and improvising on the spot. So they might be pinning down a groove, and it's all about the poetry. So I think what we're doing is something slightly different, perhaps still shaped by the image of the singer-songwriter and perhaps the medieval minstrel, certainly the rock star. But I think certainly as we move into the Anthropocene and the changes that are coming, I think these kind of roles are going to be more important and gain a kind of social traction. And I think that need for those kind of figures will bring them back.
What you were saying before about when you teach, you use your skills as a musician to read the room and feedback the right energy to them, and you know that's obviously what's missing, that feedback in when you're listening to it digitally. Mm. We live in a you know profoundly sick, messed up society, and I wonder if the role of music, if it were to change, things might get better in society in some way. I was seeing these studies about how. You were talking about the cortisol levels in babies, but also there's been studies showing the music effect on plant growth. Mm-hmm. And And when it's, you know, rhythmical and nice and whatever, the plants grow very happily compared to controls. And when it's non-rhythmical and it has a negative effect on growth, and actually the plants grow smaller. And there's also, I think, too little attention given to just the effect of sound on the body in general. So I did see another study about traffic noise and how there are strong correlations between, you know, traffic noise and cancer and diabetes and stroke and all these kind of things. And so I wonder if people should start, you know, thinking of music as a you know, an essential tool to health in some way. When you're playing music in front of people, do you feel that in any sense, that there's a kind of a sort of group healing, a sort of giving of health to the people? Does that come across at all?
I've never put it in those terms, and I certainly wouldn't want to say I'm a healer. But the moments I've always lived for as a musician, and I still live for them in the classroom, is that moment where I'm not playing the music is playing me. And there's this glorious moment where the audience gives you their attention. They freely give you their attention. That's such a gift. That's so precious. You're choosing to bestow your attention upon someone, and you feel it. You feel it palpably, and then that brings the music out in you, and you give it back, and then it becomes this virtuous circle of everyone is giving. It's no longer, hey, I'm up here, you know, strutting about with my mandolin, adore me. That ego part gets out of the way, and you get this extraordinary feeling of connection, this extraordinary feeling of magic. And everybody is touched by it, everybody is transported by it, and everybody knows, I think, when it's happening. Everyone's been to a gig that is legendary, and you listen to the recording and you hear all the bum notes and the things that weren't working. It's not about that. It's about gloriously and unashamedly being in the moment, and that moment of connection. And that, it's not about perfection. It's not about being note perfect in a classical music way. It's about being attentive and listening, so that emergent magic can happen, and then...
Well, there's something about attention which is extremely nourishing as well. Yeah. And there's a, you know, a Japanese concept of ki, you know, chi, I think people call it in England. That's your attention. It's like a vital life force going into you when you get attention. And, you know, if someone's talking to you, and or if you're talking to someone, they look away and kind of stop listening. You know, that feeling of the lack, the break of that attention stream, it's, you feel loss in some way.
Yeah.
But... So in order for there to be these musicians out there doing these good things, of course, like you're saying, they need to spend thousands of hours mastering an instrument and becoming excellent at it. And our society at the moment doesn't really give room for that, because, like you say, you know, there's a Cinderella concept you were talking about. I maybe 15 years ago, I was involved in an ayahuasca circle in London, and they were largely squatters, and they were living in a squatter community. Those were the few people I've met who used their time for, you know, mastering themselves in that way. They felt, because we didn't have to constantly worry about money, finally we can use our time just to create art and just become better at something and try and, you know, spread some joy in the world. And it was great to see that. But in the time between since I saw them and now, there's, you know, there's this reduction of squatters' rights now, and, you know, they can't do that anymore. And it seems that there's a kind of reduction of the role of the bard, the role of the musician, the role of the community musician in our society. And I'd like to see a return to that somehow.
Yes, and I was in a way very lucky that there were a few more cracks in which to exist or eke out a living, and those seem to have been largely papered over, so that now when people sort of get to college age, they come with a lot of anxiety, they come with a lot of debt, and they feel they have no choice but to get the best paid job they can, which is not easy, and then they get 0 hours contracts, and so we're squeezing people ever harder. So that glorious moment of youth where you're supposed to be carefree and able to pursue your dreams.
Find your passion.
And find your passion is sadly hard now.
Yeah. Well, despite bardism no longer being a profession which pays the bills, I think a lot of people like yourself, are kind of taking part in this archaic revival of this lost art, which I gather parallels another one of your interests, which is Druidry, which you're also part of the kind of modern incarnation and revival of. So firstly, do they relate? Are Druidry and Bardism joined in some way, or are they completely separate?
Well, yes, they are joined. Whether they were in the ancient past is a good question. So why do we call ourselves Druids? People who do. I still use the term. I still identify as a Druid. There were some original people, we think, called Druids back in the Iron Age, and we know this because the Greeks and the Romans wrote about them. But the Druids, assuming that they did exist, did not write anything, and so it's all our sources are secondhand and at one remove, and they come with an agenda. So it's slightly hard to know what is true, what is fiction. But Julius Caesar and various other commentators say that there were three classes of people in Iron Age society. There were the Druids, who sort of performed sacrifices. There were the Vartis, or the Ovates, who were concerned with prophecy and divination. And the Bards. Now, whether the Bards was a sort of training to become a Druid, or whether they were three separate vocations, it's not clear. But in contemporary Druidry, which is an attempt to sort of revive the ancient Iron Age practices, Bardism is a pathway to becoming a Druid. So the techniques of Bardism underpin contemporary Druidry.
But so this word Druid, I picture a guy in a big hood standing and chanting in front of a tree or something. I don't really know what a Druid is or what it means.
Right.
And I think most people probably feel the same way. So maybe yeah. What does it really mean to be a Druid?
Well, we really don't know what it meant to be a Druid back in the Iron Age. I mean, your guess is as good as mine. And this image of the guy with the hood has largely come because people have been reviving Druidry for 300-400 years, and that image is biblical. You know, they thought the Druids were a sort of indigenous British proto-Christianity, and so they dressed them in their imagination like biblical patriarchs, hence the robes. If it makes you feel like a Druid, wear a white robe with a hood. I think there's a sense that what Druidry is a nature-based spirituality that provides techniques that allow you to connect in a profound way with the world about us. That's not just a superficial connection that gets under the bonnet, if you like. So it's profoundly animistic. For some people it's shamanistic, and some people, and I definitely err in that direction, would argue that Druidry is a sort of form of indigenous shamanic practice. But a lot of this is conjecture, and a lot of this is made up, and I don't have a problem with that. I think we can get too stuck on what people did or didn't do in the past, and I'm more interested in what we can leave for subsequent generations. So, sure, we're reviving and recreating Druidry. Will it be looked upon kindly and fondly in three generations' hands?
But with it being recreated now, what does that mean? What are you actually doing? Is it you're going in groups of people and chanting in front of trees, or is it?
Yeah, it can be.
Yeah. Okay. Is it simply the mindset? Is it, you know, what is a modern day Druid?
Again, that's hard to answer because there's such a diversity of Druidries around at the moment, but. If one were to generalise, Druids tend to celebrate the eight seasonal festivals that are common to contemporary paganism. So we've just had Samhain or Halloween. The next one will be the winter solstice. There's a wheel of eight of them, which connects you to the seasonal round of the year's passing. Druids certainly venerate trees. They try and make connections with the spirit and spirits of place through various meditative techniques. But you know, there are Christian druids, there are Buddhist druids, there are druids who regard it as some kind of indigenous philosophy, there are shamanic druids. So there's a whole panoply of different druidries around at the moment. And I say I still call myself a druid, but I don't seem to do many of the things that contemporary druids do. So for me, it's maybe just a convenient label for what is often just an internal way of looking at the world.
So, as you say, of course, druidry is there's a very wide range of what druids are and what they mean today. However, if we're just talking generally and try and bring it a bit more myopic, do they are they basically witches? Do they make spells and practice magic? Is that what druids are? Or are they,
That's more contemporary Wicca, though some druids do. So there's a lot of meditative work, trying to connect with the spirits and meaning of different trees. Trees are important. Animals are important. So people will often try and find a significant animal that they build a relationship with, both internally and externally. But it's about deepening our relationship with place through ceremony, through ritual, through meditation, to try and refine some sense of profound connection and therefore healing with the other than human world.
When I looked into this a bit, what is modern druidry? One of the news stories that came up was this dude in Austria. So there's a certain stretch of highway in Austria that has a number of road deaths every year, and this druid talked to the local road planning authority in Austria and said, "Hey, I'm going to do some druidic ceremony and get rid of the road deaths." And so they conducted a secret experiment. They didn't release to the public of, leaving it for a few years and seeing what happened. And the road deaths did reduce to zero during that time. And so then they released it publicly and said, "We don't know what's going on, but here we go. This druid did this." So I wonder if that's from my limited knowledge, is that what being a druid means today? Going and doing those kind of clandestine ceremonies to improve the world or something? Is that?
Well, of course it can be. Druids tend to be quite public, and so you can go to druidic ceremonies at Stonehenge and Avebury, stone circles. It has a sort of an atmosphere or a vibe of benevolence. I suppose the figure of the druid is kind of quite wise and benign. You already said guy with a beard in a hood, possibly carrying an oak branch. There's this feeling that the druid is someone who's profoundly connected to the world, perhaps with magic as well. Bardism feeds in through the quest for inspiration, which is seen as a divine force that can be channeled into creative acts. So that's a big part of contemporary druidry. But also these public ceremonies, I think that's very important. And a lot of it happens in public, but a lot of it happens in private as well. People meet in small groups, in small groves. So I should say that there are various different druid orders in Britain and in America and around the world. They all have a different flavour, they have a different emphasis. Some of them are teaching orders, some of them run correspondence courses, which take you deeper into their particular strand of druidry. For me, I love the image of it, and I love this image of someone who is profoundly connected to the plants and to the landscape and the seasons, and perhaps can manipulate the world in a way to make it a better place. But for me, it's the quest for some kind of indigenous shamanism, some indigenous shamanic practice, some indigenous healing that reconnects us to the other than human world.
Well, that's the thing. You said druids are profoundly connected people, and this connection to this other world. A lot of people have really lost that in this society. I wouldn't say a lot of people, I'd say almost everyone has really lost that in this society. And so okay, just to begin with, in the path of Druidism, if for anyone listening who feels that desire for that connection, and something they feel in a tug when they hear the word Druid, and Druidism. How does one become a Druid? How does one go into that direction? How does one?
Well, find yourself a Druid order online. There are many, and they have a strong presence, and find one that speaks to you, and you know, they all have openings. And as I say, there are various teaching orders. The two big ones in Britain are the Order of Bards, Ovates and Druids, which is I think it's got a global reach in the tens of thousands. They run a teaching course, a three-year teaching course. You're not signing up or committing yourself to some kind of strange cult that you can't leave. Then there's the British Druid Order, who take a more shamanic approach to Druidry. Go along to some meetings, go along to a public ceremony, see if you like the people, you know, if they're nutters, keep on walking. But you know, in terms of, is this one simple thing that people could do that I would say is kind of druidic? Absolutely. And this is it's not my idea, but it's an idea we teach at the college, which is the idea of the sit spot. And this is to go and find in your locality somewhere where you can sit, and it's somewhere you feel comfortable and somewhere you're going to be safe. And for people who are listening and live in the inner city, that might be hard, but somewhere where you can go regularly at different times of the day, and ideally night. And you sit there and you just quieten your mind and you observe and you notice what's happening around you, and you notice the bird life, the insect life, the sounds around you. You notice how you're responding. You notice the seasons, the weather. How are you feeling? Do you feel comfortable? Do you feel uncomfortable? And you just keep returning to the sit spot. At different times of the day, at different seasons, and you gradually get a picture, you build a relationship with place. You get to feel it. What's it like at dawn? What's it like at dusk? What's it like at midday or midnight? Who's around? When I say who's around, I mean the other than human people, the jackdaws, the pigeons, you know.
The fae,
perhaps. And I know people who do this at work in the inner city. They come out of their offices, and when their friends and colleagues go and have a cigarette, they go and sit in their sit spot for 10 minutes. And it's a profound practice, and you just start to... You remember I was talking about this bardic art of paying attention. That's what you're doing. You're freely giving your attention to the world about you. You're putting your phone down. You're not worrying about work or relationships or all that stuff, and you're listening in the widest sense of listening to what's going on around you. And I'm aware there's a crow cawing away in the background. Exactly that. So paying attention. Okay, there's a crow. What's it doing? Where's it going? What's it up to? Has it noticed me? What happens if I move? Does it notice me? How does its behavior change? And then you start to deepen these connections with the world about you. It sounds very trivial. It's not. It's really profound if you do it regularly as a practice. And I would call that something druidic. That's what I mean by druidry, is developing these kind of deep ways of listening to the world about us. I don't think we're disconnected from nature. I really dislike that way of framing it, because it presupposes there is something exceptional about humans, that we could disconnect ourselves from nature. In no sense of the word am I disconnected from nature. I'm breathing in the air, and my gut is teeming with life. My skin is teeming with life. The ways in which my life is connected with the world are many and profound. But we keep very poor company. We're narcissists. We've learned only to look at ourselves, at human culture, and increasingly with smartphones and social media technology, literally looking at ourselves. And we're narcissists. I think, you know, it's a really strong term, but it's naming the problem. We're not disconnected from nature. We're just looking at ourselves all the time. So these kind of techniques allow us to step away from the smartphone and, okay, what's going on out there? And who do I share this world with? It's not just me.
My when I say disconnected from nature, the way that I mean is that we are destroying the planet, you know, right. on a grand scale. Perhaps yes. as individuals, well, actually, even as individuals, I think pretty much everyone tends to think of nature as just a thing that we kind of exist like on top of rather than as part of, and it's just there for us to, you know, exploit.
Right.
And so your music, there was this song I noticed you've got, one of your beautiful songs, is called Asclepius.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad had a video reading The Lament of Hermes, which is about the book of Asclepius, or the book of Hermes, a chapter of Asclepius. I gather the title came from there, perhaps, maybe not. But, you know, that talks about, the Lament of Hermes talks about this, it prophesies a future when we lose our connection to spirit,
mm-hmm.
and we could say we lose our connection to nature, and spirit could be the same thing.
Mm.
And we have this decline of spirituality sort of age. You know, for many years growing up, I was interested in this 2012 Mayan calendar date, and I met John Major Jenkins. I don't know if you know of him. I interviewed him, and his take on the 2012 prophecy was that it was a 36 year cycle, of which 2012 was in the middle, and the metaphor for it was a kind of the jaws of an alligator, because when you look at the Milky Way, it has the same jaws of an alligator sort of thing, and the way that December 23rd sun aligns with the Milky Way on December 23rd aligns with this the dark rift, and we have these kind of two forks of the Milky Way, and it prophesied that humans would go into this, we become this choice, this fork in the road, where we can go into the one way which ends in abyss, or the other way which ends into a kind of flourishing of humanity. And when I look at the world around us, I fear that we are, in the way I said before, in the disconnected way, the way that leads to the abyss. I mean, if I look at the world around now, the kind of ecological collapse, the Amazon on fire, the poles disappearing, you know, all of this stuff going on, I wonder if we're going the wrong way. But I think as a younger person, I would have been okay with that. But now I'm a father, I'm no longer okay with that. And I wonder if we are actually going in the right way, and just part of this collapse is just a kind of a process of shedding all of our bad behaviors, and we've got to go through a bit of turmoil to get into the right way of living. So, you know, I oscillate between fear and hopefulness for our future. And I wonder what the answer is, how we can bring about this more beautiful future with a flourishing of humanity and a flourishing of goodness and a deep connection with nature and a deep connection with our planet and a reverence for it. And that's what I'm seeking. And so here I am asking you.
Well, I mean, I share all your concerns and worries, and I agree. I think we're at a fork in the road. But we've created a world in which everything's at one remove. So I go down to the petrol station and I put petrol in my car, and I've no idea what the effect of that petrol has had on the world or will have on the world. I just go to the shop, I get the nozzle, stick it in the car, boom, off I go, and it's always there and I don't have to worry about it. It's great. Because capitalism has created the system whereby the oil is maybe extracted in the Amazon and I don't get to see the waste, toxic waste pits and the illnesses that are caused, etc., 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 nor will I see the immediate effects of the climate warming that burning the petrol has had. So there is this fundamental structural problem which keeps us like this, and I think encourages us to be narcissists and to keep worrying about things that aren't important, like soap operas and, you know, reality TV and all that stuff. But if you start going, okay, I'm going to start paying attention to the world, even if I live in a city, I'm going to start paying attention to the world, then over time you start to notice when it feels wrong. Now, you can read all you like about climate change, but when, as you had last year, we had this bizarre Indian summer which went on and on and on all the way into November, and I was still wearing a t-shirt and shorts in November, and because I've paid attention to the seasons and I know how the seasons should be turning, it felt wrong on a visceral level. It was like a jarring note, like a discordant note, just constantly there, like traffic noise. But in the weather, just then you can feel it. So it sort of transcends rational argument. Something is feeling deeply wrong and out of kilter. And we absolutely have to find a way in which we can be reverential of the world. That doesn't mean we all have to become druids or whatever, but we do at least have to acknowledge that there is no world, there is no humanity without the world. It's not just a backdrop. We're intimately interpenetrated with it, that everything we do affects it and everything that happens there affects us. And we can't separate ourselves out. We can't just, you know, like in Blade Runner, exist in these sort of toxic cities in the middle of wasteland living on insects. There will be no world. So yes, how we get there is of course the $64 million question, and it just seems beyond belief at the moment when we should be sort of moving into action. We've elected leaders like Trump and Bolsonaro and Johnson and Modi, who are putting their foot on the accelerator, not the brake, who seem to be propelling us towards the abyss with even greater relish. And that, I mean, what is going on? I have no idea.
Well, when I've been, looking forward to a flourishing of humanity, when I take that down to an individual level, the closest I've got to become a flourishing person has been in the months after a psychedelic ceremony. Mm-hmm. And I found that my bad habits melt away for a while, and then it's quite easy to fall back into them, and that's part of the work of a psychedelic ceremony is staying on top of them and staying out of your addictions and staying true to yourself. But I found psychedelics have been the most powerful tool for myself to help me become a better person. And I wonder if the same would be true for others. Now, we live in a society where psychedelics are unfortunately illegal. Mm-hmm. You wrote a book called Shroom. Mm-hmm. So obviously you have a very deep interest in this yourself. Mm-hmm. So what are psychedelics to you? Why are they important? Why would you even write a book about them? Why are they important to you?
So I had my first mushroom trip when I was 19 and I got to university up in Sheffield. And at the same time, I discovered that some books in the library about psychedelics. And I thought, my God, psychedelics and writing about psychedelics. This is what I want to do with my life. And that first, in a way, the first trip, it sort of contains all of them. They're all there in that first trip. And I was in a friend's basement flat, and we made some mushroom tea, mushrooms that we picked ourselves. And I remember feeling this was the weirdest thing I'd ever done. This was so mind-bogglingly weird. This is so strange. This is just, it's just so weird. And at the same time, this is so familiar. I know this. I have always known this. This is really weird. It's weird, but it's familiar. Strange and familiar. This bizarre paradox of, how can I know this thing? How can I have always known this thing? And yet this is the first time I've done it, and it's the weirdest thing and most beyond my ken. And I remember I had a conker, a seed of a horse chestnut, in my hand, and I just, it was like a kind of meditation. I was marvelling at its aliveness and at the play of the grain across its surface, like the raked garden of a Zen monastery, and this feeling of the aliveness of things, and that there was a sanctity within the aliveness of things, that the mystery of everything we were looking for as spiritual seekers was contained in that aliveness. And so I'm of a generation which sort of predates the popularity of ayahuasca. LSD was still the sort of psychedelic of choice, and it came bundled in a kind of package of hippie culture. So if you wanted to be a hippie, you took LSD. That was your kind of initiation into hippiedom. You would go to festivals and free festivals and take psychedelics. You did it for aesthetic reasons, spiritual reasons, yeah. Political reasons as well. It was political. It was an act of breaking out of a worldview, and that set you apart from that worldview. Now, I don't necessarily disagree with any of that, but it meant that I took mushrooms in context that I now sort of cringe when I think, you know, going down the pub on New Year's Eve, going to gigs. Guaranteed, whenever I did those things, I had a horrendous, horrendous time. And over the years, I realized that there was only one safe context for me to take mushrooms, and that was in very small groups of like-minded people or on my own, away from people, out in somewhere wild, in the countryside, or around a fire playing music in something resembling a ceremony. And that the context for me matters, and that when done in that way, I loved what you said about the bad habits. It's a kind of psychic spring clean where, I don't know if this is philosophically true, but phenomenologically what it feels like is that I'm brought back to who I really am. Some fundamental, true nugget of me. And it always comes as a revelation, and it always comes as a shock and a surprise and a relief to go, oh, I'm me, and it's okay, it's okay. And you can clean off all the petty abrasions of the, you know, the words spoken out of line, and, you know, the petty harms and I can't think of the right word, the friction of being a social animal that means you forget who you are. And that is profoundly refreshing and healing. It's like you come out of it going, I'm okay. Ugh, I remember who I am. And it feels in a kind of spiritual sense for me. And I'm going to use a musical metaphor, that the world is a song, that I have a unique voice, and that by being me, I'm adding my voice to the song in a way that is if not harmonious, then I can't think of the word, in rhythm maybe. Harmony is another term I find problematic. Pure harmony would get very boring. We need dissonance in the world. We need a play of dissonance and consonance and harmony and disharmony and resolution. It's much more of a play for me. But it's this idea that I do have a place in the world, and that by being me, and if I can be more me, then that's good. And there's a sort of another virtuous circle. But these things are very hard to put into words.
Well, you know, I wonder if psychedelics are what can save the world in a way. I've heard my dad often say, you know, he wishes that all world leaders before taking their job were required, you know, to take an ayahuasca ceremony or something like that, because certainly for myself, and I've noticed this in others, that afterwards you become a more caring person. And you are able to become a lot more loving, a lot more forgiving, and a lot more kind, and a lot more reverential of the world, and stop treating it as a commodity and something to exploit, and something instead something sacred, and not just sacred but a fundamental part of you, and you're a part of it, and it reestablishes that connection strongly between you and the world. That's what I find to myself, at least.
Well, I'm with your father there, and I am struck. Certainly in my line of work, I meet increasing numbers of people, movers and shakers in the world, CEOs, who have had ayahuasca experiences. So it is starting to reach people with influence. But oh my God, can you imagine if if we had a prime minister or a president of the States who had that experience, how different the world would be. Right. Be extraordinary. But I don't think we're that far off, actually. I think it could happen within my lifetime.
Perhaps. Well, you know, that's that forking, like in the Milky Way. Do we go into the abyss or do we not? I think if we had a president who were taking ayahuasca, I think we go into a flourishing of humanity. That's my own sense. But, you know, a lot of people have had these ideas about psychedelics and heard their praise, and yet at the same time they've heard a lot of scare stories. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, even without the scare stories, are somewhat scared of psychedelics. Even myself, I've done many psychedelics many times, and every single time I take them, I'm afraid. It's not something I go into lightly. But for someone who's never done it, perhaps a very straight person, someone working in accounting in a big city with a very normal life, who's never dabbled in that at all, why should they pay attention to psychedelics? Why should they consider mushrooms? Should they consider mushrooms? Should they consider any of these things? What do you think?
I'm not sure it's something everyone should be doing. In fact, I'm pretty convinced it's not something everyone should be doing. I'm profoundly influenced by Terence McKenna, who said it was a calling, and that there's something in psychedelics that seems to attract certain people and not others. I mean, let's take it back to Druidry. I'm currently writing a book chapter about the use of psychedelics in contemporary Druidry, and contemporary Druids are completely divided. And there's many of the main movers and shakers in British Druidry are strongly opposed to the use of psychedelics within Druidry. They see no role for it. And I respect that position. At the same time, there's a number of people who are Druids who are trying to develop indigenous mushroom ceremonies. Now, what's the difference between the two? You know, why are some people able to go, yeah, they're illegal, I risk arrest, but I feel there's something here that is of profound significance that I cannot ignore. And other people are like, no, this has no part. I don't know what the difference is. I wouldn't want to make generalizations. But if people are called, I think it behoves people to do their research and find out what it is they're doing and what they're letting themselves in for, both on a physical level and on a psychological level, and to take all the necessary precautions. And here's where we need psychedelic elders. I would love it if more and more people who were psychedelically experienced could come out and talk about what they got right and what they got wrong and all the things that they had done, wish they hadn't done. And we need guidance. Now, McKenna talked about having a psychedelic society, and I seem to remember he said that if you had 15% of the world's population or a population had a psychedelic experience, that would be the tipping point for a psychedelic society. Now, I rather suspect he was just plucking figures out of the air, but it's an interesting question. What would it take for it to be a genuinely psychedelic society? And I don't think everyone, but I think where I would disagree with him is that it needs to be people having regular psychedelic experiences, not just once. That certainly the cognitive science seems to show that as we get older, our brains stiffen up, and what psychedelics do is they put them in a more youthful place, but then gradually we start stiffening up again. So it's sort of a reminder. So I think we're nearly at a point where we have a genuinely psychedelic society, where a sufficient number of people are doing it few times a year. It doesn't have to be, you know, every month, could be, but doing it regularly enough that it is affecting how they are in the world, in the workplace, it's affecting their creativity, it's affecting the art we see in our movies. I mean, it's already seeping into our movies. We're nearly there.
Well, I know the tech industry is largely informed by psychedelics. Pretty much all the big movers and shakers were all taking LSD back in the day, and a lot of them feel inspired by the LSD, and that helped shape them to become, you know, computer scientists. And I know now a lot of the people working in the big, you know, Google and those kind of big Silicon Valley organizations microdose mm-hmm. psychedelics, and you know, they're taking it regularly. What you're saying about the 15%, there is actually a study, which I'll link in this video, which looks into the percentage of people who must hold an idea as true for it to become a tipping point where the entire society starts feeling that way. And it's only 10%.
Right.
I'll send you the study.
Okay, yeah.
So he wasn't far off, okay. According to these guys. Okay. But so regardless of all of this, I'm looking for how can we have a healthier society? You know, we were talking about the $64 million question before of how do we save the world, essentially? How do we go into a flourishing of humanity rather than the complete destruction of the climate? So part of my quest is finding an answer to that. You know, how do we get an answer to that question? How do we go the right way? How do we change? How do we get a healthier society? And you know, part of it is looking at psychedelics and Druidism and all these different techniques and ideas. But you know, I wonder if really it just comes down to the individual wishing to nurture that connection and that reverence within themselves again. And if so, how do they get there? So you know, we need to do something. That's the clear thing, is we can't carry on like this. We need to change something so that we can leave a society that we're happy for our kids to grow up in, because the one at the moment is a lot of people share this same sentiment of, you know, I'm not sure I should have kids. I don't want them in this world, you know, because I don't, you know, it's very uncertain. And so, you know, a lot of your work seems to be about keeping the connection to that kind of ineffable, you know, sacred, mystical side of life. And this side of life, you know, underlies everything we do. It underlies all life, and yet we largely ignore it. You know, I'd say most people do, and even myself often, and far too much, I ignore it. And I wonder if we're in that age that Hermes was telling to Asclepius of, the, you know, we've lost that connection to spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And if so, how do we get it back is really what I want to ask. You know, we've lost the role of the shaman. People can go and take mushrooms, but then most people can't go and safely go and pick mushrooms themselves in a field. Mm-hmm. Most people don't know a druidic group to go and, you know, hug trees and chant in front of trees with. So how does, you know, someone who's listening who feels a desire to nurture that connection to the spirit, to the ineffable, how does someone go about and do that? The sitting spot is a fantastic idea. Is there anything more that someone can do to help nurture that relationship? How do they help that happen?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I share your diagnosis. I think what people feel is that going along with the ecologic crisis that we're facing is a crisis of meaning. And where does that come from? It's partly, I think, that our traditional meaning making institution was Christianity, and church attendance is just plummeting, and that doesn't answer people's needs anymore. People, in the light of scientific understanding, don't buy it anymore. Though the, you know, exhortation to lead a moral life, you know, who could disagree with that? But the idea of freeing yourself of sin for an eternal life after death just seems to have no resonance. And what's filled that gap is capitalism. And it says, just keep buying stuff. Don't worry about it. Just keep buying stuff. Here, have some more stuff. Whatever you want, you can have it. Here you are.
Fill that hole.
And so we buy stuff. We click on the button and it arrives, and we get a little dopamine hit and we feel great. And then it lasts a day, 2 days, and then we want something else. And capitalism says, don't worry, keep going. Now, if there were a way in which I could magically get people to break free from that, if I knew what it was, I've tried it through music. Psychedelics have obviously done that for me. All I know is that there's a hunger for it. People know that they're missing something. And because I'm a scholar of religion, I would hate to lay down any, I would hate to prescribe any kind of one singular remedy. And I think there's room for atheists in this, there's room for theists, there's room for people who are spiritual, not religious. But so I, that's why I use this term meaning, but there's this hunger for meaning, and all I would do is just encourage people to pursue it, to listen to that part of you that goes, this is not enough, my life is empty, you know. It comes back to this paying attention. Maybe rather than paying attention to how I look and the superficialities, if we start paying attention to how we feel, so turning our intention inwards, and yeah, I'm not happy in this shit job, I'm not happy in my relationship, I'm not happy on social media, then what can we do about it? And the revolution, I think, is not going to come from any one person with a red book or with a communist manifesto. It's going to erupt like a mycelium as people go, I need to break out of this. This is madness. And that might come through psychedelics, but it might come through a sit spot, or it might just come through one day realizing that this is horseshit, you know, that there's got to be more to life than this. So I'm sorry that I haven't answered your question, because I wish I knew was the answer. But my hope is that if enough people are talking about it and saying, the story we're fed, and that there is just a world of matter, of particles bouncing around like billiard balls, and there's no meaning, and don't worry about it, just get on with it. It makes no sense. There's no logic to it. I think Richard Dawkins always says that we should sort of, it should be enough that we're able to unweave the rainbow and understand what causes a rainbow, and therefore find a wonder in that. But it doesn't answer why there are creatures capable of wonder. Why is that a meaningful... You're telling me that there's meaning in the world to doing science, but where does that meaning come from? It's preposterous. So follow that urge. It could lead you to Buddhism, it could lead you to shamanism, it could lead you to just going for long solitary walks in the mountains. I don't care, but follow that inner voice, listen to it, pay attention.
Fantastic. Thank you, Andy. All right, so last thing before we sign off is Shroom. So why should people check it out? What's it got?
So my book is Shroom, A Cultural History of the Magic Mushroom. I think it's still just in print, available from all good booksellers, even physical bookshops, if you ask nicely. And I teach here at Schumacher College, and we run a range of master's programs and short courses, so do please check it out. Obviously, because I'm here, these kind of conversations happen quite regularly. So they may not be advertised on the webpage, but we have some very full and frank and interesting philosophical conversations.
Fantastic. Well, I haven't read Shroom, sadly. I would like to. I intend to. However, I've read, I think, everything you've put out online. And I got to say, you're a fantastic writer. I really enjoy you know, your lyrical approach to writing. So I having not read it, I still highly recommend everyone listening to go check out Shroom, because there's some fantastic writing behind it. So, yep, thank you, Andy, and appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.